Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, we're considering Women as a Force for Economic Change, the title of the first in a series of UBS reports focusing on the role of women in a globalised world. This first publication explored the background for the continuing untapped economic potential of women, asks how progress in this area can be measured, and considers how to press ahead towards a more accessible and inclusive global economy. The world is grappling with a sluggish economy, but finding new sources of growth isn't necessarily easy, especially in the face of structural challenges like an ageing workforce. One key force for economic change that could add trillions to global GDP may just be among us, women. So how can a better gender balance impact economic growth? What explains the enduring persistence of the gender gap? And what must the role of governments, corporations and individuals be as we work towards a solution? We start with Jamie Broderick, UBS Head of Wealth Management in the UK. He sets the scene for us by addressing a core question in this space: how to reconcile the short-term costs and trade-offs of bridging these gaps with the long-term benefits of such change.
I think creating gender parity in the workplace is a long-term investment in our workforce infrastructure. So think of other infrastructures that a country might invest in. Think of education, transport, renewable energy, broadband, that kind of thing. In each case, the society has to make the decision to invest short-term to get the long-term benefits. So a great example of that is investment in early childhood development. It's proven to pay off in education outcomes and has an economic payback when the child enters the workforce, but that could be 20 years later. And the problem we have is that corporations and politicians tend to have shorter time horizons than that. So it's really important in making any infrastructure investment that there's a longer-term social and political consensus that these investments are important.
In a sluggish economic climate, then, what difference can closing the gender gap make? Well, the benefits, says Carolyn Minashi, Global Head of Diversity and Inclusion at UBS, are many, whatever the economic backdrop.
We're talking about the gap in representation rather than the pay gap or anything like that. I think the benefits of looking at it, you know, whether economic times are good or sluggish, I think are exactly the same, which is, you know, we know, or I certainly feel positive around, you know, having better representation of women, you know, in our company ranks brings those benefits of, you know, different perspectives, more ideas, more reflective of the client base, in more equal intellectual capital rather than, you know, ignoring 50% of the workforce, etc. So I think those ring true in good times and bad times. I think there is, in straitened times, there is clearly more upside for the commercials to look at how we can possibly leverage every last bit of optimum performance from our employee base. And so it is very much in the space of, I think, what really creative, innovative leaders should be doing. I would say, however, Tom, as a practitioner, been in the space for a number of years, unfortunately what I've seen is that often when company performance starts to take a dive, often the very first things that go out of the window is a focus on talent, engagement, inclusion, all those sorts of things. And people tend to kind of regress to what's familiar and regress to what's certain and kind of comfortable for them. And some of this diversity and inclusion stuff is out of people's comfort zone. So I think there's a bit of a dichotomy there in terms of what actually happens in company cultures.
Minlan Tan is head of the Asia Pacific Investment Office at the CIO at UBS Wealth Management. Here's her take.
If women were paid and participated in the labour market at best in region levels, McKinsey have actually estimated that this would add about $12 trillion to global GDP growth within a decade, and that's an 11% boost to the status quo. So we think that that's actually a big impact.
If we're considering the difference that closing the gender gap can make in a sluggish economic climate, we must remember it's not an easy fix by any means. Think of the effort that goes into it, says Jamie Broderick.
If you think of the kind of effort that goes into creating a gender parity in an organization and in a company, it's not straightforward. So if you haven't already created a workplace that is welcoming to women, If you haven't already developed career paths for women, including those who take time out for maternity leave, if you haven't trained your workforce on things like unconscious bias, if you haven't created mentoring programs, if you haven't challenged your hiring and promotion practices, then you will not find it straightforward to conjure up a cohort of senior women at the 20 to 30% level. It's just not going to happen. So I don't think that low-hanging fruit is not the phrase that I would use in these circumstances.
So resolving gender gap issues acquires a new relevance in the current global economic predicament. With growth challenged by cyclical and structural factors such as demographic aging and falling fertility, addressing imbalances in the workforce is seen increasingly as a solution. A key argument is that rapid aging is shrinking the global labour force, and therefore addressing the gender gap by raising female participation to male levels would stimulate economic growth. Despite all of this, there are a number of reasons that the gender gap persists around the world. Here's Caroline Minashi to give her take.
I think the global context is really interesting, actually, because you see a real variety of representation levels and a variety of contexts. And you see that in global companies who essentially are the same company, just operating in different dimensions and different geographies. It is not just the companies and the company practice, but it's also very much linked to social, political, sort of economic context around them. So I often think about a young professional mum who works in Hong Kong, Zurich, New York and London, and I think about their lives and how those different women have a different experience. And when you bring in something like affordability of childcare, there is no question that in our Asian business, you see an affordability of domestic support at a price point that's probably amongst the lowest in the world, comparing to a Zurich or a London, where the cost of childcare is almost eye-wateringly prohibitive.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look in more detail at the underrepresentation of women at the corporate level and consider whom should be leading the way in driving forward a more progressive agenda. An enduring characteristic of female labour market participation is the so-called glass ceiling, an intangible barrier that appears to have prevented women from rising to high-level positions. This contributes too to an imbalance between men and women in senior corporate managerial positions. Studies suggest there's strong empirical evidence that diversity in these senior roles and on corporate boards can improve performance. One reason for this is that diversified boards make better decisions, potentially because women are more risk-averse. Leading asset owners and global advocacy groups have called for women to make up at least 30% of boards of directors based on such statistical studies. In a recent episode of The Bulletin with UBS, we looked at the role of women on the board and this 30% figure in particular. We actually spoke to Brenda Trenodan, Global Chair of the 30% Club, a group that runs a number of very specific and targeted initiatives that look to broaden the pipeline of women at all levels, from schoolroom to boardroom. Brenda runs the Financial Institutions Group for Europe for ANZ, and she explains more.
There has been a lot of research, but to be very clear, I don't think anybody has proven conclusively the cause and effect that, you know, it's actually, if you have more women, you will perform better. But certainly the research has proved strong correlation. The case is either that by doing that, the companies, you know, perform better, or better companies hire more women or attract more women. You know, we're not exactly sure. I mean, we have our theories. But, you know, why does it make good sense? Well, certainly companies that have better balance can be more responsive to the market. You know, women make up over half the population. So the more women you have on your board and in your senior management, the more likely you can respond to your consumers, to the market. Also, you're accessing a much wider talent pool. So if you're only looking at a pale male stale pool, you're really only drawing from a very shallow pool. So always much better to be tapping into the widest possible talent pool.
Sarah Gordon is the Financial Times business editor. She explains how grave a problem this underrepresentation of women has been and continues to be, both here in the UK and beyond.
The countries that do best on women in senior executive positions are, somewhat ironically, China and Eastern Europe, and that's partly because of a historical legacy of women working and, of course, a more egalitarian business environment. In the UK, I mean, the big achievement here was that after the work of the Davis Commission, we got just over 25% of boards being female, which was an enormous improvement from 2010 when the Davis Commission started its work. The senior executive positions, I'm afraid the data is a lot less impressive.
And from this boardroom story, back to the broad economic picture. If women were paid and participated in the labour market in line with best in region levels, they would add $12 trillion to the economy within 10 years, a better than 10% jump in global GDP. That being the case, why isn't progress in this space happening fast enough? Caroline Menashe, again.
What we know is that when this becomes a focus for organisations or governments and becomes a strategically important, you know, a really strategically important objective of the firm, actually progress does happen. So, you know, I think we've seen that in the UK with the Women on Boards Initiative, with the, you know, amazing work that Lord Davies did. I mean, we saw an absolute step change in women's participation on boards. I think there are, you know, nations like, you know, Canada, for instance, has had some amazing progress in a fairly short amount of time, similar sort of stuff. So I think there's no question that you can accelerate progress when it becomes a strategic objective of the leadership of the firm.
And how does Min Lan Tan explain all of this?
There are costs and there are trade-offs and there's a price to be paid. So, for example, I think at the level of the family, families will have to accept different domestic arrangements. That's one issue.
Given a potentially understandable short-termism in politics at times, what's the role to be played here by private enterprise compared to governments? Who needs to lead the way? We asked Jamie Broderick that question.
I think they both have a role to play. I mean, I would say, you know, government is unique in being able to create tax incentives for things like expanded child care and parental leave. It can dictate national standards for things like parental leave. And in some countries, they actually go so far as to create quotas for female representation on boards. So it can dictate public reporting on gender pay gaps. Government is also really, really useful in creating public awareness and consensus, back to that concept of consensus on gender issues. And it also typically controls the education system, which can reshape people's attitudes toward gender from an early age. So that's the role of government. I think what private enterprise is good at is it's much more focused on the execution of gender parity. So it's typically inside the companies themselves that you get the full economic impact of a fully enfranchised female workforce. So the government activities that I mentioned remain kind of theoretical until the companies sign on. But you do need both parts to work. And I think back to this concept of infrastructure investment, long-term infrastructure investment requires that societal, social, and political consensus. And you really can't do that without government. So I wouldn't leave it to private enterprise solely.
Given the need for a more holistic approach to this challenge, how should the private enterprise government balance be struck? Well, partnerships between the two always work best, as Caroline Menashe explains.
Of course, organisations can go way beyond their local government context, and actually in many areas of inclusion, organisations are trying to do that. But it's quite difficult to do that, and then you can, you know, fast make yourself a bit of an outlier. We've also seen environments where the government in various economies are trying to provide much more progressive employment rights. But then if that's fundamentally, it's not rocket science, if it's fundamentally not felt within an organisation as a safe thing to do, what we know is that employees actually do not access the things that they actually might be entitled to. So whether that's, for instance, a universal right to request flexible working, and yet by far the majority of employees do not take up that right or do not even explore it for fear that there might be some negative impact on their career, whether it's, you know, a legal right to take paternity leave, and yet we have dads, you know, in many organisations not feeling that's a safe thing to do either. So for me, it's this partnership between a strong employment legislative framework that really aims to help people balance their sort of working and home lives, and a supportive company culture that is really around inclusion, because there are commercial benefits at the end of that. So this isn't just about creating an environment where it's very employee-centric. It's employee-centric because actually that's the best approach around winning the war for talent, being an employer of choice, creating sustainable, retained employees for the long term. So those would be some of my thoughts.
Finally on the programme, a last word to Jamie Broderick. It's critically important, he says, to restate and to articulate gender as an explicitly economic or business issue.
There are lots of moral, religious, ideological, political reasons to agitate for gender parity, and that advocacy is essential and needs to continue and grow, no question about that. But there are a lot of people who do not share these beliefs and values, or who share them in a passive way, and are not motivated to act. So when you add the economic and business arguments, which is what the UBS study is doing, you potentially engage a population of important decision makers, especially men, who would not otherwise be engaged in this critical issue of gender parity. And I think one of the reasons I'm so enthusiastic about the study is that it does exactly that. It asks the issue of women and gender parity as an economic or business problem to be solved, rather than, as you say, a moral or religious issue, where you tend to have groups preaching to the converted, but you're not reaching men, who in most cases, certainly in corporations, are the majority of the workforce.
And that's Jamie Broderick bringing us to the end of this 119th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or catch up via iTunes or on your preferred podcast platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.